From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, new protests break out against police brutality in many American cities. The U.S. House of Representatives passes a bill barring presidential action on immigration.
If this president is allowed to stand, it will render meaningless the separation of powers and the checks and balances that comprise the fundamental architecture of our Constitution.
And scientists try to protect coastal reefs in California. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. Protests in New York and other U.S. cities continued Thursday, following a New York grand jury's decision not to charge a white police officer in the death of an unarmed African-American man. VOA's Carolyn Weaver reports.
Demonstrators in New York and other American cities, from Chicago to Minneapolis, protested Thursday over a New York grand jury's decision not to indict a white police officer in the chokehold death of Eric Garner, an African-American man. The case has become another flashpoint for the issue of police use of excessive force against people of color in many American cities, as President Obama acknowledged Thursday.
Too many Americans feel deep unfairness when it comes to the gap between our professed ideals and how laws are applied on a day-to-day basis.
Graduate student Monica Melton demonstrated in New York early in the evening before the peaceful protests closed several major arteries.
It's becoming a really disturbing and unfortunate trend with Michael Brown, Eric Garner, and countless others. And I wanted to show my support and say that, you know, this is not something that's going to be tolerated.
New York Mayor Bill de Blasio said the city's police force will undergo 3 days of retraining to reduce unnecessary use of force and give confidence to all New Yorkers that they will be treated equally.
They need to know that in doing this crucial work, our police will always, with every fiber of their beings, avoid any needless injury and, God forbid, avoid any death that could have been stopped.
In Cleveland, Ohio, where police shot and killed 12-year-old Tamir Rice in November, he was holding a fake gun. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder said the Justice Department's nearly 2-year-long review of Cleveland police found a pattern of excessive force, and the department will come under federal supervision.
The city has acknowledged that the department's findings that raise issues of importance to people really throughout this community. And together, we have agreed to a statement of principles that will lead to a court-enforceable consent decree.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
Among those protesting in Washington, student Nicole Dashiel grew up in Cleveland.
It's finally gotten my hometown the effects of racialized police violence, and I just wanted to let the world know that a lot of Americans are upset about this, and we want it to change.
Civil rights leaders, including Reverend Al Sharpton, have announced a national demonstration for December 13th in Washington. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill which would bar President Obama from implementing executive action to defer the deportation of nearly 5 million undocumented immigrants. The president's recent immigration action has angered most Republican lawmakers who say the president has overstepped his constitutional authority. The bill, however, is largely viewed as a political message to the president, as VOA Cindy Sain reports from Capitol Hill.
Republicans took to the floor of the House to call for support for the bill introduced by Representative Ted Yoho to nullify the president's sweeping executive action announced last month to shield millions of immigrants from deportation. Republican Representative Tom McClintock said the president has triggered a constitutional crisis by taking unilateral action.
If this president is allowed to stand, it will render meaningless the separation of powers and the checks and balances that comprise the fundamental architecture of our Constitution.
The White House says the president is acting well within his constitutional authority to defer the deportations of the parents of U.S. citizen and permanent resident children to keep families together. The White House issued a statement saying if the House bill were to reach the president's desk, he would likely veto it. On the Senate side, Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid has said he will not bring the bill up for a vote. Democratic lawmakers say former Republican President Ronald Reagan also took executive action to shield undocumented immigrants and that he was not accused of causing a constitutional crisis. Democratic Representative Luis Gutierrez stood on the House floor beside a life-size paper cutout of former President Reagan. He faulted House Republicans for not passing immigration reform like the Senate did in 2013.
Apparently, the majority prefers to take symbolic votes instead of legislating real and lasting solutions.
Analysts say Thursday's vote was a way to let his frustrated Republican members vent their anger so they can go ahead and approve a government funding bill next week. Republican House Speaker John Boehner indicated he would rather postpone another big budget showdown until the next Congress arrives in January.
Next week, the House will work to keep the government open while keeping our leverage so that when we have reinforcements in the Senate, we're in the strongest position to take additional actions to fight the president's unilateral actions.
Republicans will take majority control of the Senate in January, but before this Congress leaves for its holiday recess, both the House and the Senate have to pass funding bills to avoid another partial government shutdown, like the one that lasted 16 days in October 2013. Cindy Sain, VOA News, on Capitol Hill.
Well, meanwhile, Australia's conservative government has passed a new measure that toughens that country's immigration laws. It was reintroduced temporary visas for refugees that do not allow them to settle permanently in the country. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Changes to Australia's Migration Act were narrowly passed after a fractious debate in Parliament. With the support of non-aligned micro-parties and independent senators, the government has reintroduced three-year temporary protection visas, or TPVs, that don't allow refugees to live permanently in Australia. After the visas expire, the holders could be repatriated. In return, ministers have promised to increase Australia's overall refugee intake by 7,500 to 18,750 people each year, and free hundreds of children held in detention. The government insists that TPVs will give refugees the protection they need, and should their home countries be deemed safe in the future, individuals would be sent home. The new laws will allow Australian authorities to process a backlog of 30,000 asylum applications. In the end, the changes were dependent on one vote, that of the Motoring Enthusiasts Party's Ricky Muir. He told Parliament that Immigration Minister Scott Morrison had told him that without the new laws, thousands of asylum seekers would be left in limbo.
He has publicly stated what it means for those 30,000 people is they will just wait longer and longer and longer. I believe that this bill has many bad aspects. However, I am forced into a corner to decide between a bad decision or a worse decision, a position which I do not wish on my worst enemies.
Critics of temporary visas say they heap great uncertainty onto the lives of the vulnerable. Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young told Parliament that the immigration minister had used undue pressure on Senator Muir to ensure the laws were passed.
He was told the only way to get these children out of detention was to pass this bill and this package. Using children as hostages is never okay.
Temporary protection visas were used by Australia's previous Conservative government, but scrapped by the left-of-centre Labour administration after the 2007 election. They're part of tough immigration policies designed to stop asylum seekers trying to reach Australia by boat. Those who do are sent to processing camps in Papua New Guinea and the Pacific island of Nauru, and are denied resettlement in Australia. Most of these people are believed to be from countries in South Asia and the Middle East. The government in Canberra has also instructed the Navy to tow or turn back migrant boats. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. A growing number of nations are increasingly censoring parts of the internet and passing laws to allow for greater surveillance of what people do and say online, according to a new report issued by Freedom House. The report released this week, entitled Freedom of the Net 2014, is an annual survey of 65 governments and their policies regarding the filtering or censoring of online content. It also looks at the types of electronic surveillance they conduct and how they may punish citizens whose online activities they disapprove of. VOA's internet correspondent Doug Bernard has been reading the report. Susan Yockey asked what he's finding.
Well, things aren't looking quite so good for internet freedom. Now, of the 65 nations that were surveyed, 36 were rated lower on measures of internet freedom than in the previous year, and only 12 saw measures of freedom tick upward. Now, this is also the fourth year for this survey, and every year there has been a slide downward. So there's a clear trend here for more restrictions on the internet. Now, the nations that had the most dramatic declines were Russia, Ukraine, and Turkey. And overall, similar to past reports, the countries that really rated the worst in terms of internet freedom were, again, Iran, Syria, and China. Now, the nations that were deemed to be less free than previously include some chronic rights offenders, such as Saudi Arabia, Zimbabwe, Vietnam. But also on the list was the United States, where the report authors charted minor increases in what they called limits of content and also violation of user rights. And among the nations that were seen to be doing better, sort of an interesting list, they include Myanmar, also known as Burma, Tunisia, Cuba, and India. Now, each of them for reasons specific to those nations, so there's no real unifying trend there. And finally, interestingly, Iran was also rated marginally more free because of a slight easing on censored content. Now, that despite the authors' conclusions that Iran remains one of the worst offenders globally for violating users' free expression and privacy.
You mentioned Russia and Ukraine having the most serious declines. Is that connected to the conflicts there?
Well, definitely, but in some very different ways. So, for example, in Ukraine, beginning last year with the Euromaidan protests, the Yanukovych regime began aggressive surveillance of protesters, as well as targeting journalists who published their work on the web, in many instances getting very rough with both groups, attacking them, kidnapping them, that sort of thing. Now, much of that stopped when Petro Poroshenko took office, so things began poorly there, but ended a bit better. Now, Russia's a different story. Freedom House research analyst Laura Reed told us that authorities there have seriously ratcheted up censorship of content on the internet, most notably critical voices and independent media.
They used a new law that was actually passed in December. This new law allows the prosecutor general to issue orders to block online content related to extremism or calls for unsanctioned public protests. And so this law was then used quite quickly to block independent media outlets within Russia that were either reporting on the events in Ukraine or that had been critical of the Kremlin.
Are any regions of the world generally more or less free?
Well, the most restrictive nations are generally to be found in Asia and the Middle East, but again, for different reasons. So, for example, Syria has been one of the most aggressive electronic surveillance programs that can be found anywhere, and often with very dire consequences for those deemed to be hostile to the Assad regime. Then right next door in Turkey, where there's a much freer environment overall, Prime Minister Erdogan has been waging something of a private war against the internet and social media in particular. Now, that probably has something to do with the fact that there were some YouTube videos a while ago that allegedly showed misconduct by his government basically some very open mockery of his regime on Twitter. Clearly, he doesn't like that, and that's really angered him. Now, generally speaking, the Americas and Europe are among the freest web nations, but the leaders there are not the United States. but rather Estonia and Iceland. And that, no doubt, has a lot to do with the revelations by Edward Snowden about all those classified NSA surveillance programs that have got a lot of people around the world riled up.
So the trend has been for a less free internet over the 4 years of these reports. Why is that?
Well, there's probably a lot of reasons for that, specific to each nation. But that said, Freedom House researcher Laura Reed told us that governments may be paying more attention to the internet for the simple reason that more people are on it.
Globally, we have seen more or less this trend of as more people are online, as access increases, you also see sort of a crackdown in subsequent years from the government in cases where that increased access is deemed problematic by the government that is in power. So on the one hand, access might be increasing. That's a good thing for internet freedom broadly. But then on the other hand, it depends on the quality of that access, what that access means for citizens within a given country.
And finally, to end on perhaps something of a positive note, the report also did highlight some areas of improvement in web freedom. Those came about mostly as a result of civil liberties groups and just individual citizens paying more attention to how they can guard their privacy online and also figure out ways to get around all of those government blocks and censors.
Very interesting. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
That was VOA's internet correspondent, Doug Bernard, and he was speaking with Susan Yockey. The world's coral and rocky reefs are threatened by overfishing and global warming. That's according to the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Producer Dion Moses takes us to California's Pacific coastline, where volunteers are diving to protect reef ecosystems.
Coastal California is home to one of the most spectacular marine habitats in the world. But as with many ocean ecosystems, human population growth, pollution, and overfishing are threatening the existence of rocky reefs and kelp forests.
In my opinion, I've seen the kelp go from really, really thick to really, really thin, but it is important to monitor it.
Erica Fellens is with an international nonprofit organization called Reef Check, part of a growing movement in the United States called Citizen Science. She and hundreds of other volunteer divers are trained to track the health of kelp forests as well as coral and rocky reefs found around California. This summer, Reef Check documented a 25% decline in 24 different fish populations since 1970. Citizen scientist Stephen Campbell is monitoring the rocky reefs around the Channel Islands off the coast of Santa Barbara.
Reefs are really sensitive to temperature and ocean acidity. So with global climate change happening, you have rising sea level, warming water, and increased acidification. So they help serve as a proxy for marine health.
The Channel Islands are a marine protected area. That means people can dive, kayak, or snorkel in the area. But fishing is prohibited during certain times of the year. These volunteers monitor reef conditions year-round, noting, for example, any changes in its shape or size.
Your transect, you're characterizing the relief of the reef, which is like the variation in depth along the transect. And then you're also characterizing what's on the reef. So it might be algae, it might be invertebrate. There might not be anything, and you note that down. And then the last thing you're characterizing is if it's reef or cobble or boulder or sand. So that's basically how coarse the grains are.
Reef Check works with nonprofit organizations and government agencies. With more than 1,600 kilometers of coastline to cover, rough seas and limited government staff for underwater surveys, Campbell and the other citizen scientists are filling a gap.
In California, doing things like this, surveying reefs so we know what the reef diversity is, and then giving that data to people in management and policy so they can actually use the data and then say, we need to protect more areas if species diversity is declining. I think that's sort of catching on now. I know.
He says California is in the forefront of preserving marine ecosystems. Despite the decline in fish life, the report from Reef Check also revealed encouraging signs of recovery in California's network of marine protected areas. Dion Moses, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
This is Today in History. On December 5th, 63 BC, the Roman philosopher, politician, and orator Cicero read the last of his Catalan orations, revealing to the Roman Senate a plot to overthrow the government. In 1349, 500 Jews in Nuremberg were massacred during the Black Death riots. The killings were the result of the false claim that the disease was due to a Jewish plot to kill Christians by poisoning local wells. In 1791, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart died in Vienna at the age of 35. Mozart's genius came to light early. He created more than 600 compositions during his lifetime. On this day in 1766, James Christie held his first sale in London. Taking advantage of London's newfound status as the major center of the international art trade after the French Revolution, Christie's soon established a reputation as a leading auction house. On this day in 1848, President James Polk publicly confirmed rumors of a huge gold strike in California. His words triggered the Gold Rush of 1849. The Gold Rush transformed California from a distant province to a popular destination for settlers and traders. On this day in 1945, five U.S. bombers taking part in a routine training exercise over the Atlantic Ocean disappeared in flight. The mysterious loss of Flight 19 sparked years of speculation about the dangers of what became known as the Bermuda Triangle. In 2008, human remains previously found in 1991 were finally identified by Russian and American scientists as those of Tsar Nicholas II. Nicholas and his family were murdered by Bolsheviks following the Communist Revolution in Russia. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes Ukraine's announcement that it has formed a new government. This sets the stage for the difficult but necessary process of implementing reforms and delivering results, said Vice President Joe Biden. The United States will support Ukraine's new government to stabilize its economy, strengthen democratic institutions, and fight corruption. The U.S. will also continue to stand for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity in the face of Russian aggression. Since the September 5th Minsk ceasefire agreement, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry at NATO headquarters, Russia has funneled several hundred pieces of military equipment and material, including tanks, armored personnel carriers, and heavy artillery pieces directly to pro-Russian separatists in Ukraine.
Russian military forces still operate in eastern Ukraine, where they provide command and control support for the separatists. And Russia and the separatists it backs obviously could make a very different choice here. And they could come to the table and they could fully implement the Minsk agreements.
NATO also expressed its concern over Russian aggression in Ukraine. In a joint statement, the NATO-Ukraine Commission strongly condemned Russia's continued and deliberate destabilization of eastern Ukraine in breach of international law, including the provision of tanks, advanced air defense systems, and other heavy weapons to the separatists, and military activities which violate the agreements reached in Minsk in September. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg stressed that in the face of Russia's continued and deliberate destabilization of Ukraine, NATO will continue to show firm political support for Ukraine's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity. This includes enhanced defense and security support from NATO members so that Ukraine can better defend itself. The United States and its allies continue to stand with the Ukrainian people as they pursue democracy, peace, prosperity, and independence, free from any outside interference.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.